Okay, welcome. If you brought your Bible, you can open with us to Exodus. Exodus 20. Saw the word creation and got thrown off there. Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11 is the, finally, we've come to the fourth commandment, or what theologians have started calling the end of the first table of the law. Generally speaking, you'll find that the Ten Commandments lay out into 4 and 6. Those are the two halves, as it were, of the Ten Commandments. The first half, they would say, deal primarily with man's relationship to God. The last 6, from 5 to 10, deal with man's relationship to each other. So having dealt sort of with the vertical relationship, it begins then turns to the horizontal relationships that we have with each other. And you can decide for yourself whether that's compelling for you to break it down that way. But today we come to this last command. It's our first command that's actually positively stated. And it starts with this idea to remember a certain day. By far, my favorite writer on the topic of a Sabbath day, of Sunday, as it were, is a guy by the name of Eugene Peterson. If you don't know this guy's name, this is a good one to know. Eugene Peterson is still functioning, he's still writing, he's still teaching, I think. Was at Regents College out in Vancouver for years and years. But Eugene Peterson, in his book on the Lord's Day, talks a little bit like this. He starts asking people about something about to explode. That was really funny because it started getting faster and faster, and you're kind of like, something's going to blow up. He starts by asking this question. How do you define a day? And he tries to get people to think about this idea of what is a day. I mean, for most of us, a day starts when? It starts when we wake up. We begin the day sort of a little bit haggard, a little bit tired getting the motor running, but we try to get our life accomplished, and then we sort of collapse exhausted into our beds, and we look and say that that's a day. Well, if you go back to the book of Genesis, chapter 1, you'll find that when God, in the orchestra and symphony of creation, starts to create, the day is defined differently. And I never noticed this until he went and described it, that in the Jewish mind, the sort of original Hebrew audience to the very text that we're looking at this morning, began the day with evening. Because at the end of every single day, and I'll bet you if I asked you and I said, how does each of the days of creation end? Well, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And then you would say, and there was morning and evening the first day. That's sort of naturally what you would say. I have to confess that even I said that. But that's not what the text reads. The text actually says, and there was evening and there was morning the first day. In other words, it begins with evening. So Peterson goes on and talks about the fact that the Hebrew mind thinks about a day differently, that it actually starts at night with sundown. So here's what Peterson said. I'm going to read 2 quotes from Peterson. They're so good. He says, our day begins with an alarm clock ripping the pre-dawn darkness and closes not with evening, but several hours past that when we turn off the electric lights. In our conventional references today, we don't include the night except for 2 or 3 hours that we steal from either end of it to give us more time to work. Because our definition of day is so different, we have to make an imaginative effort to understand the Hebrew phrase, evening and morning, one day. This is much more than idiomatic speech. What is involved, this is my sort of summary statement here, is a sense of rhythm. All right, hold that thought, because that's exactly where I want to go today in talking about this. You see, when God created the world, He began with darkness. Everything got started in darkness. And from the midst of that darkness, there He spoke light and stars and vegetation and animals and finally mankind into being. And what Peterson says is when we sleep, we enter, as it were, sort of as a living metaphor, into that pre-creation darkness. He said it's a semi-conscious state, and he said we become completely unproductive. We don't have really much cash value, as it were, when we sleep. And this, Peterson says, is when God really gets to go to work. He quotes from C.S. Lewis's favorite theologian, a guy by the name of George MacDonald, who says that sleep is God's creation for giving us the help that he can't give us when we're awake blocking him. In other words, he finally has us in a place where we can be used, which is asleep, dead to the world. Why is that? Well, here's Peterson's conjecture on this. I love this. He says, when I quit my day's work, nothing essential stops. I prepare for sleep, not with a feeling of exhausted frustration because there is yet much to be undone and unfinished, but with expectancy. Why? Because the day is about to begin. God's Genesis words are about to be spoken again. During the hours of my sleep, how will he prepare to use my obedience, my service, my speech when morning breaks? I go to sleep to get out of the way for a while. I get into the rhythm of salvation. While we sleep, great and marvelous things, far beyond our capacities to invent or engineer, are in process. The moon marking the seasons, the lion roaring for its prey, the earthworms aerating the earth, the stars turning in their courses, the proteins repairing my muscles, our dreaming brains restoring a deeper sanity beneath the gossip and scheming of our waking hours. Our work settles into the context of God's work. Human effort is honored and respected not as a thing in itself, but by its integration into the rhythms of grace and blessing. Look, I love this idea mostly because of how often Peterson uses the word rhythms. In other words, what he's saying is that in the Ten Commandments, we've got these commands that God gives to us, but because they're made by a God in whose image I am created, I can expect, therefore, for what's reflected there to say just as much about me and how I work as it's saying about God's intentions for the way I'm supposed to live. That's been my whole premise, this study, is God says something in the Ten Commandments about the way I work, the way I function, the way I work the best. And when we get to the fourth commandment, I think it's saying simply this, that life has a rhythm. That life, as it were, has a percussion section that moves on a regular pace and a tempo that is defined by seasons sometimes. It's defined by months. It's defined by days. And the percussion of creation, that it, when it is honored in us, creates blessing, great blessing for us. And when it's ignored, just like every other commandment, it brings us great deterioration and disintegration. Look, you're just not paying attention if you're not aware of the fact that our culture is one of the most overworked and under-rested and overstressed cultures that has been, like, created in all of time. Like, it was actually about 15 years ago that Juliet Shore wrote a very popularized version of this idea called The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure, where she chronicled saying that most of our futures are saying that Americans are overstressed, anxious, and thereby destroying our marriages and our children by not being able not to work. Being unable not to work. And I'll be honest with you, it's almost become fashionable, I think, in many circles, that when there's nothing else to talk about, when someone says, hey, how's it going? The first thing that you say is, I'm worn out. Worn out. And the truth is, it's not a lie. We are actually worn out. Well, God is saying in the fourth commandment in the book of Exodus that I am recreating the world. Like, because of our sin and the fall of mankind, humanity is just crumbling around us, and we are inflicting it upon ourselves. But if you want to be a part of rebuilding this, I want you to discover that there is one day in seven where you must do something, and that is to stop. To get in touch with a rhythm of life, we can all sing the Lion King in the back of our minds for the rest of the time, but it's not just that we are to obey God in sort of keeping the Sabbath, but we are to follow his lead in creation while he makes a new creation that will be defined to some extent by our ability to stop working. Call a timeout to rest. Okay, so as per usual, we are going to do this the way in which we've done it each week. We're going to look at the positive side of the command, that is the positive command, and then we're going to look at the prohibition in the command, the negative part of it. The positive side of this command is actually stated in the command. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. And then it says, 6 days you shall labor and do all of your work. So the positive side of the Sabbath command is to exercise and engage in work. What tends to happen when you're tyrannized by the idea of work is you begin to think of work as a necessary evil, like it's an evil unto itself. But a proper understanding of work and rest is actually a blessing to us. And I would say this for starters, and this is one of those things that isn't always super apparent to people right out of the gate, and that is this, that work is a fundamental human need. There is a basic necessity to your humanity that needs to work, that needs to sense productivity. Why? Well, we get this from the first three chapters of Genesis. What's fascinating about the way in which God creates the world and creates work is God commands His people to work before they sin and fall into a sort of rebellion against God. So work itself is not a necessary evil. Sometimes we imagine heaven like this, don't we? We're kind of like, whew, man, oh man. You know, death will be welcome for me because I can finally get off this treadmill. I'm just going to do nothing for eternity. Be great. Rest. You know, apparently I'll get a harp. I'll figure out how to play that. I'll sit on a cloud or something like that. But that's an ungodly view of work. There is no reason to expect that we will do any less work that God asks of His people to do in the new heavens and the new earth than He asks us to do here. I expect, and you should expect, that we will all have jobs on into eternity. And if that depresses you to think now, it means that you probably have an unhealthy of your view of your work now. When the truth is, there is something fundamental to our humanity that needs to be productive. People intuitively want to know that what they do is making an impact, that they're pushing something forward. Look, for our culture, we have to ask ourselves, what is the purpose of your work? Why are you working? I would argue that when it's not given for like sabbatical reasons, which I understand companies do that and people construct those things the way in which they could and should, there are oftentimes when I have the most leisure time and the lack of sort of steady rhythm in my life, the worst things come up out of me. It's funny that when I get out of those regular rhythms of life, there's something that's there's a drift inside me into something that's really not that great. I won't go into that. But there's damage that's done when we look at work as if it's an aside. And I'll say this. I think this is important for the young people in the room. The idea of working, I know, looks just kind of like, ugh, that'll be great to start working. But there'll be a day in which you can look back and say, well, hey, I did something. I made my mark. The world is a little better place today because I did my thing. I sold people a good that was workable. I built something that was worth seeing. I fashioned a mind. The work of doing education is on everybody's plate living in Oxford, Mississippi, is it not? The idea of fashioning and shaping a mind is fundamental to who we are. Okay, so that's the first point. The second thing that we end up saying a lot in Reformation circles about work is this simple idea that all legitimate human tasks are equally God-given and equally spiritual. It's a very big deal, especially for those of you who grew up in evangelical religious circles, which I'm assuming is a lot of you. Martin Luther was the one who sort of launched this idea because he grew up in a time in which there really were two classes of work. There was the religious class, which was the ecclesiastical church work, which was full-time Christian service. And then there was sort of the plebes, the sort of underclass that was sort of doing the day-in-day sort of drudgery work. But Martin Luther said this. He said, the humblest servant maid sweeping for the glory of God is just as honoring to God, just as infused with dignity as the greatest preacher in the world. Wow, that is huge. This was huge for me. I mean, I grew up having the sort of idea foisted on me, that there was full-time Christian service, which is a funny phrase. Are you in full-time Christian service? No, I'm in part-time Christian service because I'm a part-time Christian. I'm only Christian part of the time. Doesn't make any sense. But what happened was is there was sort of this sense of dichotomy that, like, there's if you're really going to be spiritual, you're going to go and do this. Now, look, there ought to be a couple of notions that come from this idea, though, that God actually smiles upon these kinds of work. First of all, it's really encouraging. It's encouraging because of how often I see so many of my friends who came up through evangelical circles and live with a powerful undercurrent inside of them about feeling guilty for the job that they do. And feeling guilty because they didn't make the choice when they were in college to go into full-time Christian service. And for some reason, I find this more prominent among women than I do among men. I had a conversation years ago, this is probably 10, 12 years ago, in the Grove of all places, with someone who was, she was someone to whom I put into a category of someone with whom all bets are off, namely a mother of preschool age children. Okay? If you are in that zone, your life is there will never be another time in which your life is the madhouse that it is with preschool age children. So I'm asking you to own that. But she was lamenting this fact. She was like, you know, every day I get up and I face a mundane sort of experience of, first of all, not liking these little creatures that God gave me. I mean, look, high school people, don't let this unnerve you, but your parents, you were awful as children. But here's what we did. We came to church, you know, and we smiled, and everybody was like, oh, how lovely, how lovely. And in your mind, you thought, oh, just don't make me go back home because there's no nursery at home, you know, where we can kind of give the child to for a small break. But we go through those things, but then all of a sudden, you know, we go out into the workaday world, and that, for some reason, feels so mundane and so boring. This woman looked at me, and she said, I just feel like I made some mistakes in life. I feel like I could have been out there serving in such a way. I could have been out there sort of doing really God's work, and now I'm just completely handcuffed to be able to. And there was just this cloud of guilt that hung over her, where no one had sort of walked her through this idea that, like, look, those diapers are an expression of godliness for you. That daily sort of, it's not daily, it's hourly. Sometimes every 15 minutes, there's a judgment call to be made. Is there not, mothers of preschool age children? Did I feed them enough or too much? Did I let them have too little TV time or too much TV time? Am I being a nice mommy or am I being a mean mommy? And what comes out of you in the midst of sort of that kind of stress makes you look and be like, everybody told me that I would just love and go floating through motherhood, and I might kill these children. And here's what's funny, is young mothers don't know what to do when that comes up out of them. Does that make sense? They don't know how to look at me like, oh, what does that mean? I'm a horrible, terrible person. And suddenly here comes the cloud of guilt that follows them all around. Look, it's hard. I don't know anything harder. Why do you think your husband goes to work? He doesn't want to be there in that place. So he's like, I'm going to go bring him the bacon, which is infinitely easier than whatever you're going through at home, despite his, like, well, what did you do today but sit around? If he says that, then that might be grounds for divorce. But you could talk to the elders about that. Here's the deal, though. Those things done for God's glory. Now, notice I said legitimate human tasks. The person who makes their job stealing and sort of gouging the poor, the person who barters in illicit material, those are not legitimate human tasks. But it does get us interested, does it not? That I'd like to do something that was actually helping people, that was actually advancing the kingdom and not sort of squelching it. So yeah, there we go. And thirdly and finally, Christians work out of a sense of freedom and not slavery. Well, this is a really good one here. His favorite sort of Eric Little Chariots of Fire illustration. You know, Eric Little says to his sister Jenny, you know, God made me for China, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. In other words, Little was saying that when I exercise these gifts that God has given me, I begin to feel God's pleasure. And that pleasure that I feel in him is an end in itself. That I'm not working for something when I get that, because that itself is what is joy. But what's interesting about the Chariots of Fire movie. It's a 35-year-old movie. Nobody's ever seen it anymore, but it's out there. You can watch it. It's a great movie. Is the alter ego is the Jewish preacher Harold Abrams, right? Who is running for a very different reason. And in one scene in sort of the training room before the big race, he's talking about his thoughts and he says, "All my life, I've never known contentment. I'm forever in pursuit and I don't even know what it is that I'm chasing. But I suddenly realize that I am given somewhere over 10 seconds to justify my existence." What's the difference between those two? Eric Little on the one hand saying, when I run, when I exercise this gift, I sense God's smile on me. He's taking joy in me. Whereas Abraham said, you know, I've got 10 more minutes to sort of, 10 seconds to justify my whole reason for existing. Both of them are striving for excellence, both of them. Yet one of them is filled with joy as they do. The other one is filled with discontentment. Same job, same ability, same career, same training. One has joy and one is miserable and discontent. What's the difference? The difference is the heart. Little is working because he knows he's loved by Christ, but Abraham is working so that he can satisfy an unquenchable longing in his heart. So you can't work well. We do not work well unless there is a bass note inside of your soul of peace. And this is one of the reasons why there is no greater theater to unfold the pathology of your own heart than watching what you do every single day, day in and day out. Our work, our stuff we got to do to make life going is one of the most vivid places in which stuff is going to come up out of me. There's nothing quite like it. How can we get that base note of peace in the heart that allows me to be able to work with joy and not feel this sort of oppressive tyranny over having to get up another day? Well, that brings me to the second point. I'm glad you asked, he said, setting them up. Because the Bible says we have to rest. I love this picture of this old man. You know, I love searching on the internet for the images to put in Sunday school. And for some reason, he's just awesome. You can tell that this guy has no interest whatsoever in being productive this day. Today, he's just going to let the sun shine on him. Look, work is a good thing. But because work is such a pervasive part of our lives, there will always be a constant temptation to let work be the ultimate definition for who we are. Work, therefore, has an alter ego, and that is rest. And when we rest, we say to the world that I am satisfied in who I am, that my job does not define me. Okay, we talked about how hard it is to be a mother of preschool-age children. Gentlemen, have you noticed, probably didn't notice this, that right after college, it actually started your senior year of college, you began really to be defined by the second question any person you've ever met for the first time ever asks you. The first question, presumably, if they're a cordial person, is, so tell me your name again. My name is Les Newsom. Great, Les, nice to meet you. And what's the next question, gentlemen, that they're absolutely going to ask you? I mean, everybody knows it. So what do you do? What do you do for a living? In other words, from the very earliest of fashioning moments, a man is sort of functioned to live his life and to define his life on the basis of what it is that I do. You're a new person and a person of potential value. What do you do to demonstrate that value? Ladies, if you don't believe this, watch what happens in him when he loses his job, or when his job is threatened, or when the future of his job is unsure. This happened to me 5 years ago prior to taking the job that I have now, and I can tell you it was ugly. And those people right over there were the greatest recipients of it. It's my family. Over there. Look, it's a huge temptation. Rest, though, is a way of saying to the world, my work is not the ultimate definition of who I am. The Sabbath command to set aside Sunday as a day when you say no to work is not so much given to us because you need a nap. This is amazing how often this, that the conversation about Sabbath keeping degenerates into that, be kind of like, I don't know, Les, I just run at a different torque, you know? I mean, if you need that rest, great. But the way I rest is like heading off to the office for just a couple hours to get a little things cleaned up so I can hit the ground running on Monday morning. Right? Or worse, if saying like, well, you're not going to do it on Saturday. Saturday is worship of college football. And what's so funny is I'm talking about myself in that sense. Like now I've entered into the recruitment phase of the obsession, you know? This is like until February the 5th, which is signing day, for those of you that are not aware. Is that right, February 5th? 3rd. Wow, 2 extra days. See there? You just lifted my grade, just lifted. Or so you've heard from other people. That's exactly right. Gray and I share this. Look, rest is not because our bodies need to recoup, even though I do think that's a legitimate application. It's probably quite true that our bodies sort of need that kind of rest. But I think what I do is I rest by so that I can say to that, to myself and to the world around me, the world is going to get along fine without me. Think about Romans 4, verse 5, and what it says and what Paul is talking about. Remember, in Romans 4, Paul has just unpacked, it's helpful that we've been studying this, Paul has just unpacked this incredible doctrine of justification by grace through faith. That we are not justified on the basis of how well we have performed. The Christian view of peace and joy and salvation is buried in this idea that God is not going to grade you on your efforts, because your efforts will never come close to what He needs and what He requires. And so lay your deadly doing down. Down at Jesus' feet and stand in Him and Him alone, gloriously complete, as the old hymn said. What does Romans 4 or 5 says? And to the one, listen, who does not work but trusts Him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness. Just as David also speaks of the blessing of the one to whom God counts righteousness apart from works. You see what Paul is saying? He's saying that there is blessing and fullness and shalom and peace and contentment only in the one who, here's the quote, does not work. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't work. We're not going to go to work anymore. What it means is the one who trusts in his work to save. This is why I said that there's nothing like the Sabbath command to really get at the central heart of the pathology inside of us. Nothing will uproot a sort of legal spirit, a spirit of legalism, quite like a command to rest. Why? Because there is no greater act of faith than resting. If you want to know how to define faith, one of the best ways is to be able to rest. Listen to what Peterson says about this. Back to Eugene Peterson. He says, when we rest, we acknowledge that all of our striving will of itself do nothing. Rest means letting the world pass us by for a time. Genuine rest requires acknowledging that God and our brothers and sisters can survive without us for one day. It requires recognizing our own insufficiency and handing over responsibility. It is true surrendering to the ways of God. It is a moment of celebration. Good grief. We have no idea how to celebrate in Presbyterian circles. I'm just going to throw that in there, okay? And maybe one day we'll ask more about that. We have no idea how to celebrate. When we acknowledge that blessing comes only from the hand of God, this is why rest requires faith. It's also why salvation can be pictured as rest. When we rest, we accept God's grace. When we do not seek to earn, we receive. We do not justify, we are justified. Tim Keller makes a great point when he says that how hard it is to rest on something that's moving. When I was growing up, we used to take youth trips, and the youth trip was always included getting on the bus. To this day, whenever I have that strong smell of like diesel exhaust, I always feel like I'm about to get on a bus and ride off to Colorado to go ski. We used to go to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, of all places, for our youth retreats. And some of you are saying, wow, that's sad. And it really was. This is pre-Dollywood ages, so because that certainly would have rescued the experience to go to Dollywood. But I remember being on these buses late at night, because we'd always start the trip at like 11 o'clock at night and drive through the night. And I could never sleep on that doggone thing. Some of you have clear consciences and can sleep like that. I, on the other hand, just am completely jostled and could not get settled. Well, the reason why that's true in the soul is because if you're trying to rest on your accomplishments, it's always moving. If you're resting on your relationships, they'll always change. If you're resting on your marriage, let's say you've got a fantastic marriage, but you've had that dark moment. You've had that dark moment in your marriage where you realize, eventually, we're going to have to say goodbye. If you're resting on your children's success, good luck with that. If you're resting on relationships, people move away. People move to other cities. Look, Jesus is saying, look, there are so many things out there that are just shifting. You can't stop it. Heraclitus was like, you can never step into the same river twice. It's constant change around us. There's only one foundation, the solid rock of Christ, that you can build your life upon. And at that place, declare to the rest of the world this revolutionary idea that I'm not dependent on you to say who I am. Okay, so how do we apply this? Well, here's some happy people who want it applied to them. That actually is the default picture that I forgot to change. They just look so happy. They're happy. All right, number one, Christians and Sundays. Well, the first thing that we could say in application is Christians throughout history have gotten in touch with these very rhythms of life by not working on Sundays. Now, I realize that this is extraordinarily controversial right out of the gate. And it's sort of a fact of the... It's a problem with a discussion that as soon as you even say that, people's sort of defenses go up. Well, you clearly don't understand. First of all, I have no interest in having the conversation about, well, you know, if everybody stopped on Sunday, you know, you wouldn't have water coming into your house. You know, you wouldn't have da-da-da-da. I know. I do recognize that there are vocations... Hey, guess what? Ready? Mine. That require people to work on Sundays. I understand that. I'm not interested in sort of fighting about that. Nor do you sort of, is it helpful, I think, to sort of try to weigh out the Sabbath question by figuring out what you can and cannot do. In many ways, it's sort of a typical sort of perspective that we take. Look, I think that it's simple to say, I will do the best that I can. To whatever degree that I can, that whatever I do for 6 days in the week, I'm not going to do on Sunday. I'm going to reserve it. I'm going to make it a delight, as Isaiah, the book of Isaiah says. Isaiah says, look, the idea that there might be a day where I look at the world and say, you know what, I think you'll be just fine without me, is actually a good thing. And finding a day in which one can do that. For those people that can on Sundays, finding another day in which there's a time. But there's something about, in a sense, sort of coming here that affirms that, does it not? We gather with the people of God. I remember, and since she's here, I'll poke fun at her here. Anna Grace, when she was very, very little, having a conversation about going to church on Sunday, and her saying at one point, I don't want to go to church. No kid wants to go to church. Why? Well, because it's boring. And I said, yes, sweetie, that's exactly right. It actually is boring. I never wanted to sort of lie about that. That's true. There's a sense in which it's mundane. There's some rhythm to it. I recognize that. But you know what? Not every time in which your mommy and I go out on a date is it like the most super exciting thing in the world. It really isn't. Sometimes we sit there and we eat our meals and we make small talk. That's just kind of what happens. But church is our date with God. We set that time aside that we go to be with Him. We go to gather with the rest of His people in the way in which He wanted us to be so. Invariably we're going to lay, well, what about da-da-da-da-da at the end? That's fine. Ask those questions. But I'm going to try to set something to say, what would it look like to build my life around something positive there? No one would be more disappointed if Cody at Nukes was not working on Sunday, because I would, you know, come to pieces. Cody is the manager at Nukes, and yes, he knows me by name as well. Be awesome. I'll tell him today that he was mentioned in Sunday school. Yeah, they said, let's all go to Nukes and say hey to Cody. Our Sunday school teacher talked about you. That'd be great. Suddenly, is that spit in my salad? What is that? Secondly, Christians and productivity. Look, I simply want to pitch something to you that the rhythm of life is so profound that there's a sense in which the Sabbath command appeals to us on the basis of psychological health when we get into habits. Productivity experts have done a lot of work in the last couple of decades. If you haven't noticed, productivity sections in bookstores are exploding. Why? Well, I think there's, the more frenetic and sort of splintered our life gets, the more people want to know how in the world they're supposed to get things done and try to rest in the society. Well, whenever I talk about productivity, I realize it's very dangerous because there's two different kinds of people that are wrestling through questions of productivity. The first are those people whose life is defined by the chaos. There's a tendency in sort of an inside where your life has no rhythm whatsoever. It's just sort of a cacophonic blasting here and there. And we use excuses for those people that are super orderly and careful as being like, you know, I'm just not wired that way, or I'm just a free spirit. When the truth of the matter is, it's an excuse. It's oftentimes an excuse. What God is saying is the sort of start-stop frenetic thing is going to wear against you, and oftentimes it will wear against those around you without finding a sense of rhythm. I remember when I read an article, this was a few years ago, where someone said, look, give this a try. This is going to be hilarious to some of you. Give this a try. Try making up your bed every day before you start your day. Give it a try. Now, look, it was a small little task, but the mentality behind it was start your day with one in the win column. You know, I got a list of things to do that I will never get touch with, but you know what? Ta-da! Here's a simple thing that took me 3.5 minutes that I did. Now, some of you are looking, going, that guy has lost his mind. Look, this is me. This is not God saying, thou shalt make thy bed before you get to work today. But there was something about sort of setting a thing out there, a little one in the wind column, that gets you going to realize that, like, no, this is kind of what we do. There is something powerful about deciding that, no, this is the time when I'm going to bed. And saying that this is the time in which I get up. You're going to find that college students, you know, will plunge into the darkest depths of depression because they have no idea that these rhythms exist. Sure, we'll push on. I mean, it's 4 o'clock. I can get 1 hour of sleep, you know, before I go to class. It's the first time in which your body kind of looks at me and goes, we're not going to do that any longer. And you start breaking down. You start getting emotionally distraught. What happens? You lose the sense of rhythm in life. Learning to set goals. How many times have you ever had a life coach come into your life and sit down and say, how about this? How about that? What about this deal? Learning to track your own progress. And then at the end, celebrate it. Celebrate it. Stop and say thank you for those things that sort of came in and through your life. In other words, what we need, there's a first group of people that really need to hear the commandment's exhortation to work and make that work a celebration. That's the first category of people. Now, if you're in the second category of people, you'll know that because you've been sitting in a bath of self-satisfaction for the last 4.5 minutes. Because you've been going, man, if he could only let me talk right now. I have got it down. Wait till you see. In other words, you, the other people in the room, are those who are crushing all those around you with your hyper-efficiency. In other words, orderliness and efficiency has become such an idol for you that people honestly don't think that they're actually dealing with you, but a very mechanized version of you that is about the rules and the program more than it is about them as a person. There is nothing like dealing with a real human being to throw you off whatever rhythms you thought that you had, because it happens that way. It throws people off. How many times has dinner discussion suddenly turned interesting? There's a teachable moment going on. But suddenly, you get up from the table to leave the table to start to clean up. Why? Because it's 7:30, and if I don't do this now, I'm going to be late to get the kids to bed. And suddenly, we crush moments of joy because we can't take a Sabbath from my sense of productivity and when life takes a left turn. You see how both sort of extremes, those whose life is just kind of like, I don't know, we'll get there eventually, and those people who are like, we're going to do this. For both people, they are tyrannized by an inability to Sabbath. Back when I was wrestling through this question of productivity and rest, I came across a book by a Jewish author. He was a therapist in New York. I'm not even sure he's still alive, but Neil Fior wrote a book called The Now Habit. And it was a book on procrastination. Now, again, this is a secular psychologist, counselor, Jewish guy who said this. This is a quote from his book. He said, "People do not procrastinate because they are lazy or irrational. People procrastinate, rather, because it makes sense, given how vulnerable they feel to criticism, failure, and their own imperfection." Ooh, wow. People procrastinate because it makes sense to procrastinate. Why is it that I look at work, and there are times in which I see that to-do list, and all I want to do is just be like, ah, la, 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 ah, la, 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 la. I don't want to look at it. Have you ever had that? I will tell you where mine exists. It is in my voicemail inbox, okay? If you love me, you will never leave me a voicemail. You say you love me. You say you have affection for me, but yet you won't stop leaving me voicemails. My voicemail inbox is tyranny for me. It's got a little blue dot beside it when I know that it's unlistened to, because I know that there's something there for me to do. It is infinitely better to send me a text message or an email. Just please don't send me a voicemail. I hate my voicemail inbox. And I look at that number on my phone, and it just rises up, and all I want to do is just be like, oh, let's just put my phone down and kind of walk away from it. Why? Because that's part of my job. Why is it there? Well, procrastination, Fior says, makes sense because inside of me I feel so vulnerable because I feel like a failure. And the funny thing is about the sensation of failure, you know, hyper-productivity people are kind of like, well, it's just very simple. If you feel like a failure, just go apply yourself to it. Just return the phone call, Les. You're not listening. There's something going on inside that's keeping me from it. And until that gets settled, until that gets dealt with, then we don't know how to deal with work or rest. In other words, productivity or a lack thereof is a window into your soul. And we're realizing that one of the reasons why we are so driven to say yes, yes, yes to everything is because we so dread displeasing people. We are people pleasers. The reason why I can't say no to work is because my people pleasing is killing me there as well. Because everything hangs on the balance. Until there's something that gets at the soul that actually is outside of, why can't you leave the office, leave work at the office? Why can't I stop? You know what? If I can't settle the question of what's inside of my soul, then sort of no amount of vacation is going to remedy that. Because you'll still, even on vacation, be tempted to go and check that email. You know, you find yourself sneaking, you know, sort of away from vacation just to be kind of like, is everything okay? World getting along without me? Look, okay, since we're doing family member things, this has always been a great day. I remember somewhere after 4 or 5, 6 years of marriage that there was a very subtle, small commitment that my wife had made that was quite transformational for me. And that was that she had decided that when, and she would always be very careful, she'd be like, if you could just call on your way home. I'd be like, sure, it was always kind of my thing. Whenever I'd climb in the car from campus to head home, call ahead to Ginger, and you know, hey, I'm on my way home, blah, 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 you know, check in, whatever. The reason why she wanted that was so that she could sort of whip the kids up into a bit of a frenzy, you know. It takes them like 15 years to realize that, like, oh, Daddy's coming home. Okay, so. But when they're little and you're like, Daddy's coming home, they're just like, yes, yes, Joel. They never think for 2 seconds to be like, so? He lives here. Why wouldn't he come home? But what was crazy was, is for about a few years while the kids were little, you would open the door and also there'd be this like, Daddy, sort of go rushing at you. And I would say more times than not, Ginger would make sure this would happen on my way home. Well, what happened in the midst of that? What happened was, is Ginger made home a place where I wanted to be. Now, a lot of y'all were students. It was great to hang out with Gray Flora when I was a campus minister. Best thing in the whole wide world. But it wasn't as good as going home. Why? Because it was a safe place to land. The fourth commandment will get you asking the question, is there a place inside of your soul that is a safe place to land? Fashioned by Jesus as a dwelling place that given the opportunity is a place where you love to be. That I love to be in that place. The fourth commandment gets us to ask a question about whether the gospel was really good for us. Whether it really is a place that I look at and be like, no, I know that when I bow my head to pray, I'm going to meet someone there who's glad to see me. This is one of the reasons why my prayer life is as terrible as it is, because the gospel has yet to purge from my mind this idea that Jesus waiting for me looks a bit like this. Oh, well, it's good to see you. Been a while, don't you think? Oh, now that you're in trouble, you're going to come see me? He looks so disapproving in my imagination. Why? Because that's exactly how I act. But at what point do I actually get to a point where I lay, again, my deadly doing down at Jesus' feet, and stand in Him and Him alone, gloriously complete? Is there a time in which when that gets fashioned, that I mark out a place in my imagination to say, I know where home base is. And it may not be at home for you. It really may not. You may be at war with your spouse at this point. You may be at war with your children at this point. And home is a place where you dread. It may be that you've fallen in love with work and sold your soul to it and would rather be there than any other place. All those things, though, are passing. They're failing. Is there a place inside? Is there a home inside where you know that someone is there who's glad to see you? That's the question of the fourth commandment. All right, so living with the manufacturer's design on working and resting. Questions and comments. I left lots of time for Q&A today on remembering the Sabbath. Yes, Greg.
Whereas in the Old Testament, there's a sense of failing to observe the Sabbath will actually invoke curses. A lot of the history of even deportation is linked back to a failure to observe the Sabbath. What is your sense of actually invoking curses today for failure to observe the Sabbath?
Yeah. The question was basically for those in the back. You not only get senses of Sabbath keeping as being like a place. Most of us speak about Sabbath like if you don't obey the Sabbath, then you'll miss a blessing. But there seem to be certain passages that suggest that if you disobey the Sabbath, you will invite cursing. I don't know what I would say to that. My first stab at it is I really do think that the blessings and cursings of the law, this is like the book of Deuteronomy. I know you're thinking, of course, I was reading Deuteronomy just this week, Les. Deuteronomy is really, the best commentators on Deuteronomy will say that the book of Deuteronomy is a commentary on the Ten Commandments. There's some great literature out there to show how you can sort of break up the book of Deuteronomy with each commandment. It's fascinating. And what it talks about is that each commandment comes with a set of blessings and cursings. I've always understood that to be sort of both sides of the same coin. In other words, there's no doubt that if I make an idol, let's take the first commandment, not having other gods before Him. If I make an idol, I fail to receive the blessing that I get when I worship the one true God. But what also happens to be, in the sense of having lost that sense of blessing, is I've also invited the tyranny of whatever that idol is for me. You know, you make an idol of wood and stone, well, you're going to become wood and stone. We talked about a couple weeks ago. That's my first stab at that, is that the inviting of a cursing is to invite the curse of what work can do to tyrannize me, which is what we've been talking about. That's my first stab, but I have to look at that more. I'm going to be at RTS all next week. I'll ask one of the Old Testament professors that very question. Good question. Any other thoughts? Yes, Susan. Well, let's narrow it to Isaiah 58. There's no doubt that of all the strong Old Testament statements about Sabbath keeping, Isaiah 58 is the toothiest, probably. It's very strong in its demands of being like, here is the reason why judgment is coming upon you, is because you've treated my Sabbath days as if they are nothing. You've trampled over them. You've gone and done whatever it is you want to do on the Sabbath day and have not made that whole thing holy. My impression of that sort of first out of the gate is that the Bible, when it deals with God's commands, oftentimes treats me as if I am a small child more than I am a grown-up child. A grown-up child, you can sit and you can be rational with. Hey, let's weigh the pros and cons here. Like, don't you see how your idolatry is sort of really crushing you? And, you know, let us reason together, you know. you can be rational. There are some times where you've got to take a small child and just look at it and be like, don't think. Stop thinking. Just follow me. Don't look around. Either. Just come with me, right? And it's a blessing to them. Why? Because no amount of explanation is going to help. I do think you get to passages in Scripture where the Bible is saying, you're not listening. And the truth is, you're not listening because you can't listen. And since Isaiah is one of the prophets, you typically get very strong, toothy sort of statements that are there where God is saying, you're trusting in yourself way too much. Blah, 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 Sabbath, Sabbath, Sabbath. I get it all, but you know, we still got this, this, and this. And he's as if he's saying, I don't want to have to treat you like you're a small child. But I think that's what you get at Isaiah 58, is that he's having to say, you're thinking in terms of what you want to do, and there's other reasons to appeal to yourself, like don't trust yourself. I'm going to appeal to you on the basis of what you need. That's my best shot at that one. Everybody's got to learn to sort of digest Isaiah 58 if you're going to take the Sabbath seriously. Any other thoughts? Yes, Gray.
What about, I know even in our denomination, some people would identify themselves as Sabbatarians, meaning like they don't engage in any kind of commerce, things like that. And obviously that's not everybody.
Yeah.
It's not like necessarily something that we say is like, you know, part of our, you know, our theology.
Mm. Yeah. There would be those that you would come across, even in our circles being the Presbyterian Church in America, the denomination to which Christ Pres is a part of, who would be what we would call usually a strict Sabbatarian. And these are those who, you know, engage in no commerce. They stay away from any kind of activity whatsoever. They kind of shut phones down, shut TV down, shut everything down, and stay sort of in an isolated sort of state. I don't know that I've got a comment about that. I want to honor the consciences of those who have felt very strongly about their interpretation and of those particular passages. The other strain, as it were, and I don't identify with either of these two strains. I would not refer to myself as a strict Sabbatarian. My relationship to Cody, case in point. But there is another view which people refer to as the continental view of the Sabbath, which what you have during the Reformation, I'll be honest with you, the idea of Sabbath keeping was a bit controversial during the Reformation. Lots of people kind of went back and forth on what was and was not appropriate for people to engage in on Sunday. And if you read our own doctrinal standards in the Westminster Confession of Faith, especially in the larger and shorter catechisms, you'll find what is a fairly, if it's going to sort of slouch to one side or the other, it's a bit stricter for reasons that we could talk about later. But the continental view of the Sabbath sort of went like this. I don't want to misrepresent it. That is that when Jesus shows up on the scene and redeems people from the, what do you call it, the ceremonial law. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff in the Old Testament which we do not shoulder on the backs of believing people because we believe that when Jesus died on the cross, he got rid of those laws. Things like making sacrifices, okay? We don't sacrifice any animals. If you're a visitor here today, there'll be no animal sacrifice later on in the service, so whew, you can breathe a sigh of relief there. Well, why don't we do that? Because it's commanded in the Old Testament. Well, the answer is we believe that Jesus, in his sacrifice on the cross, sort of nullified the need to have any other sacrifice. That makes sense? Which is one of the reasons why this, by the way, is a table, not an altar. There's no sacrifice that's going up here when we serve the Lord's Supper. There is rather a dinner where we're sitting around as a family. That's important. Now, what does that mean? Well, that idea then for some people, there's a passage where Paul is talking about people who hold certain days to be significant than others. Now, I hold Paul talking there where he's saying, I think he's talking about the old Jewish feasting sort of code, that those things are abrogated. But there are others that say, no, he's also talking about Sabbath keeping in a very strict sense, like from Isaiah 58 as well. That's the continental view of the Sabbath. So therefore, what we're encouraged to do is to find one day in seven, but that seven is not a big deal, or that really that basically took that command and sort of expanded it to all of life, that we're just supposed to be marked by resting rather than sort of setting aside very strictly one day. So you'll find that there are those two sort of satellites are out there, and somewhere in between there is a healthy way of asking yourself about the Sabbath. Now, some of you are kind of looking going, wow, I really never thought this could be that boring. And that's okay. That's okay where you are. I simply want to do this. I want to throw the concept at you just to set it down somewhere in your heart so that if just for a moment you'll stop and look back and be like, how do I deal with my work? And what does that bring out inside of me? And maybe give yourself the opportunity to sort of let the gospel work on that place. And then whatever application comes from there, then you can allow the scripture to inform you in that. But in the meantime, let that sort of be the center. Lee? It's also one of the ten as well, was my also thing. It's like,
right, one of the ten. So, but the other thing I was about Isaiah 58 is if it's a day to delight in him, in some ways it's saying, but you're with me. I mean, it's like if on that date night, all you can do is look at your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's more of a, but don't you get it? This is your time with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope you didn't hear me commending the continental view. Good. Yeah, I was simply saying that is the other voice you'll hear in our own denomination. All that spectrum across those two are people in our denomination that have advocates on either side. Yeah.
Why do you think God rested? Talking about creation, it's a little bit more confusing to go from like our world, our human reality, to thinking of God resting from his work on the seventh day.
So he could take delight in himself. Exactly. In other words, we call the Sabbath a delight in the way in which he did, because he showed the pattern of the fact that he is a God who lives in rhythms. I think this is the whole orderliness of creation, that you know the days and the pacing and the rhythmic nature of it is showing that I'm a rhythmic God. I'm a God who lives in the base of rhythms. Therefore, that's going to have an echo in you. So when I rest, I'm taking delight in all that I see. Which he actually says after every day, but in the seventh day, he really looks back and says, I rested so that I can call it all good. Everything in here is good. So that's you get a sense of some of that stuff we talked about last week is like, what is the chief end of man? To glorify God. What is God's chief end? To glorify himself. That's what he's doing on the seventh day, I think. Good. All right, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Let me close in prayer. We'll finish up. Then, Lord Jesus, would you, if nothing else, would you let us... let us draw near to you. Can we find that maybe there's something in us that's afraid to draw near to you, that maybe has distanced ourselves from you? Maybe there's been a funk that has grown up in our house between us, that we've allowed some guilt, some shame, some sin to come between us. Would you help us deal with that? Would you give us confession? Would you give us repentance? And then, Father, give us your word, so that at the end when we pronounce a benediction over our service, it really will be a good word for us and to us about your joy that you take in your people. And in the end, let us call the Sabbath a delight. For we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.